Hi everybody, today is Tuesday, April 29th, 2025, and our friend Leith Maroof is back with us. Welcome back, Jay.
Good to be with you, Nima.
We've learned, Leith, at least we've learned from Yemen that the Yemeni armed forces have confirmed an attack on the USS Harry Truman aircraft carrier using missiles and drones, and forcing it to retreat from to the far north of the Red Sea. When you look at the situation right now between the United States and Yemen, how do you feel that Yemen is getting better, is getting in the way that they're fighting the United States?
Yeah, I mean, the story that the American Navy is telling us is that Harry Truman was trying to escape from these missiles and drones and did a hard turn, and somehow the F-18 fell off the aircraft carrier. I mean, it's like, really, you think this huge aircraft carrier can do a donut or something in the water, right? And it can go sideways. This is a ridiculous story. Clearly, the Yemeni armed forces were able to shoot down this F-18 somehow. And this is the second F-18 that we have confirmed been shot down by the armed forces of Yemen. And so it seems like the Yemenis are developing their weapons as they go through this testing of the confrontation with the United States. So the air defense systems, for instance, that we saw Yemen perfect and add components to from these old Chinese and Soviet air defense systems to be able to take down the 20-somewhat MQ-9 drones. And now we see how through this confrontation over the last year, the Yemeni armed forces were able to redesign their missiles and drones to cause more of a threat to the aircraft carriers, and to even be able to hit the F-18s as they're going back and or taking off from these aircraft carriers. I wonder personally, because obviously the Yemeni armed forces are not giving us the details of their new weapons. That's something they have to keep secret. But I wonder how these F-18s have been hit in the air so far away from Yemeni territory. So maybe, and this is I'm just putting this out, I don't have any proof about it, but I think the Yemeni armed forces have developed their drones to be able to have kind of a suicide run on these F-18s in the air. That's the only way I can imagine the Yemeni armed forces being able to take down these F-18s so far away from Yemeni territory. Remember that during the battle of Lebanon here, we saw videos released by the Israeli military of their F-18s and F-16s trying to chase Hezbollah drones over occupied Palestine and being unsuccessful. So maybe the Yemenis took that and flipped it the other way. Now we have the drones chasing the fighter jets and taking them down. And that's I think, the only logical thing that I can think about of how this happened.
Leif, in terms of Yemen and what's going on in Yemen, do you feel that is it possible for the United States to somehow make a chaos within the society in Yemen, using, you know, all the forces they have, from Arab states to even Turkey? They're all helping. But how is that going to work? Do you see any sort of upper hand in doing this, or the society is somehow united in Yemen in favor of Ansar Allah?
Yeah, well, the vast majority of the Yemeni population, something like 85% of the population, lives in areas that are controlled by the Sana'a government. So the, you know, less than 20% that live in areas that are controlled by the Saudis or the Emiratis, that's not enough of a population to cause troubles. The other thing is that they live in flat areas of the desert. So it's, you know, a failed military tactic to try to go up the mountains from the bottom. That's, it's not going to succeed. And we've seen 10 years of that attempt and it didn't work out. We also actually saw over the last 24 hours, the government of Aden, the capital in the south, have much of it has defected from the Saudi Emirati control, and they were in a joint meeting in Sana'a and have pledged their loyalty to the Sana'a government. And this is happening because the Saudis and the Emiratis are empowering Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the south of Yemen. And the government of Aden is not formed of these Wahhabi death squads. And the more strength that Wahhabi death squads have, the less relevance it is the Aden government. And so, you know, the Aden government has learned from the experiment of Syria. Remember, in Syria, there was all these quote-unquote democratic opposition to the Assad government. You had the Syrian council in Turkey, another one in Qatar, a third one in Saudi, and they were all supposed to take control of the government when the Assad government falls down. And what ended up happening is that Al-Qaeda, ISIS, THS are the ones that are now in control. So the politicians that worked for the Saudis and the Emiratis over the last 10 years in Yemen are now worried about their future and finally realize that they're the only way that they can guarantee a say in the future of Yemen is for them to build an alliance with the Sana'a government that represents the majority of the population. And so that's very significant. We haven't seen something like this since the beginning of the war. Clearly, both the events that happened in Syria, the events in Lebanon and in Palestine over the last 15 months are causing a dramatic shift in the loyalties inside Yemen, because you already know the outcome. What is it going to be in Yemen if Al-Qaeda and ISIS are successful with the sponsorship of the Saudis and Emiratis?
How about Saudis and Emiratis? And are they, let's put it this way, with the new attitude that we've been witnessing between Iran and Saudi Arabia, do you think that the way that they're thinking about Yemen is going to change, or they're going to keep the same old policies toward Yemen?
You know, it's impossible to straighten a dog's tail. You have to chop it off. And after 100 years of being good house slaves, the Saud family and the royal family in Emirates, it's impossible to see them switch sides, especially at this moment where, according to everybody outside the region, they look at the axis of resistance as weakened. You know, Syria's gone, Hezbollah has been pounded hardly, and Gaza is still being genocided. So the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Qatari regime and the Turks regime, they're all right now more emboldened. They see their master in the White House and the Zionist getting away with genocide and destruction of whole swaths of land and, you know, sectarian killings in Syria on a mass scale. So I don't think that they will suddenly right now change mind. So I think the Iranian intelligence, Iranian military, Iranian government, they all know this reality. And they are trying to stay engaged as much as possible with the Saudis and Emiratis, because it's, you know, as the saying goes, keep your enemies, you know, your friends close and your enemies closer. You have to, if you have no avenue to hear what is happening within the Saudi government and Emiratis, you'll be surprised when things happen. Therefore, it's better to have these relations. And the file in Syria, the situation being so dramatic, I think the Iranians want to stay in touch with the Saudis and Emiratis because of the internal squabble between the Zionists, the Turks, the Qataris, the Emiratis, and the Saudis over influence in Syria. This opens up avenues to have some influence for Iran on the situation.
You mentioned how the Yemeni forces are improving. When we talk here in the West, when we talk about Yemen, they talk about these people are so poor, they don't have any level of education, high level of education. But what is the real picture of Yemen, of the armed forces of Yemen? How do they study things? Where do they study? And do we know anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I want to start by saying it's been more than 100 years that we haven't seen one leftist or progressive do anything useful in the West, right? Nothing revolutionary comes out of there. And then we hear this criticisms of Yemen. I mean, Yemen is way more advanced than any revolutionary movement in the whole West for the last 100 years. The Yemeni armed forces and the Yemeni people are facing the most evil, most ruthless empire humanity has known, and they're succeeding. So the real impoverished people are the peoples of the West. The real the people that have no knowledge and no drive and no culture are people in the West, not the Yemenis. The bare feet of a Yemeni child have more dignity than the vast majority of the population in the West combined. You know, this is the truth. It's hard to hear sometimes for the West, but our brothers and sisters in the West that fashion themselves anti-colonialist or anti-imperialist or progressive should be made to hear these things. Maybe they will be able to, you know, get some motivation to move off their couch to prove that they are better than what I say they are. You know, obviously Yemen has universities. The Yemeni armed forces have for a long time been collaborating with a lot of other armies in the region. And of course, since the fall of the Saleh government, the Yemeni armed forces have been reorganized, have received, you know, training and exchange of information and knowledge from Iran, from Syria before it fell, from North Korea, from Hezbollah. And this is, you know, once you have the basics and absorb this knowledge from your allies, then you can start building on it. And that's what we've seen Yemen do. And the Yemeni scientific branches of the armed forces have been able to do. And specifically, to be able to take whatever knowledge and weapons designs that the rest of the anti-imperialist camp has and modify it to fit the geography of Yemen, to fit the battle in Yemen. And that is where the ingenuity comes, right? So the weapons that are designed in North Korea are designed for the weather of North Korea, for the geography of North Korea, for the kind of weapons that the enemy of North Korea, meaning the South and or the US, are going to use. But the brilliance of the Yemeni scientific corps of their armed forces is being able to take those equipment and even old equipment and find ways to make it viable and successful to fight within the geography and the parameters of the battle that the US is forcing on Yemen. And that is the brilliance of the Yemenis.
Laith, how about the experiment they had during the days of fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, were they part of that sort of coalition from Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, together fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda? We know that they were using the arms from the United States. The arms they were using came from the United States. That's why I think they're familiar with those arms.
Yes, so the Saleh government before its fall obviously was a house slave, you know, vassal of the United States, and definitely the majority of the weapons that Yemen had were American or Western made, and we saw a huge shift. But, you know, let's just remember also that before the unification of Yemen, the south of Yemen was a communist country, and most of its weapons were Soviet and or Eastern Bloc. And therefore, like the Yemeni weapon caches, even during Saleh, were a mix of East Bloc plus West Bloc. And because, you know, the Saudis and Qataris never wanted Yemen to be strong, even when it was a vassal of the United States and a vassal of these regimes, they still didn't allow it to purchase new weapons from the West after the Saleh came into power and unification of Yemen, and therefore there was no fighter jets or good air defense systems and so on. So Yemen during its unification period under the Saleh regime had no choice but still to buy from the Eastern Bloc if it wanted good weapons. And now with the fall of the Saleh regime and the coming of Ansarullah into power, we see a return to, number one, purchasing more advanced weaponry or knowledge from the Eastern Bloc that includes the Axis of Resistance, and sending a lot of the officers to be trained in the Eastern Bloc, in Iran, in North Korea. The scientists going to the scientific study, development institutions in Syria, in Iran, in North Korea, and they brought with them all this knowledge and advanced it even further. So, you know, we can look at the Kalashnikovs in the hands of the Yemenis. We understand that the vast majority right now of weapons in the hands of the Yemeni armed forces are from the Eastern Bloc.
Late, the situation in Syria, it seems that the Druze are fighting the government in Syria. And what is the main problem that they're facing with the government?
Yeah, I mean, the HTS government, and with the prompting of the West and the Saudis and Turks and so forth, want to create a homogeneous, one color kind of state. You know, remember, this is what the West brought to the whole world with World War I and World War II, these ethno states that are supposed to be pure. You know, this is the idea that brought us Zionism and Nazism, right? And this is what they've been trying to do in the Arabic world as a whole, empty the Arabic world of minorities, religious minorities, ethnic minorities, because that in itself justifies the existence of a fascist, Jewish supremacist, one color, one race, one religion state in Palestine. If Syria was a multi-religion state that is secular, that protects all its ethnic and linguistic minorities, Israel looks bad. But if every Arabic state around it is empty of its minorities, if every minority in the region is killed by Arabic states, then Israel has a legitimacy. It can say. And that's been the experiment for the last 100 years. And Syria specifically has been one of the main barriers to achieving this goal. So look at, when we talk about the Druze, in Syria, there's the region in the south called Al-Suwaida, where there's the mountain of the Arabs, and where the Druze population have thought of themselves and looked at themselves as one of the pillars of Arab culture, of Arabism, or of Arab unification, of Arab liberation. Those who led the Syrian revolution against French occupation, at the forefront of them were the Druze, the thinkers, the writers. This, of course, this is the same for the Christian population in Syria. And so in order to rob Syria of its history, and that people look back at and find as a source of strength, of unity against colonialism, part of that, the plan that the West has is the destruction of all the archaeological sites that give people a record of their history. And the other is emptying the land of the minorities that saw themselves as a reason for unification and decolonization. So coming to what's happening today, there's a neighborhood in Damascus called Jeramana. It's near the airport of Damascus. It is where the vast majority of refugees that arrived from the Golan Heights in 1967 are living. And the majority of the people from Syrian people from the Golan Heights were Druze. And we see over the last, couple of months, multiple time HTS entering Jeramana neighborhood and trying to kidnap or kill people and kidnap women specifically. Yesterday there was a invasion by an HTS force into the Jeramana area, and the locals carried arms and fought them and killed them. They killed tens of HTS members. And that prompted HTS to send convoys now to reoccupy Jeramana. And because of that, the Druze in the Suwayda area raised their own convoys of armed men and headed towards Jeramana to protect it from HTS. So right now, part of what the Israeli-American objective is to, on the one hand, either force the expulsion of minorities from Syria and or their killing, the genocide as is happening to the Alawis and the Shias and the Christians, and or find a way to have these minorities call for protection from outside Syria to break up Syria into multiple states that are ethnically pure or religiously pure. So the no matter which of these goals happens, the Israelis will be happy. Either everybody is killed, that is a minority, and or there'll be minority states that are chopped out of Syria. And the fact that the Druze are not leaving Damascus and the Jeramana neighborhood and are fighting on the ground there, and not only kind of creating a security zone around Suwayda where HTS is not able to come in, this in itself is against what the Israelis want. The Israelis want the Druze of Damascus to leave and go to Suwayda and or to leave the whole Syria and be killed. So luckily until now, the majority of the Druze in Syria are refusing to fall into the trap that the Americans and the Israelis are laying down for them, and are taking action that is really ruining the plan of the Israelis.
How about Turkey right now? What do they want to do with the government? Are they trying to help Al-Jilani? Are they somehow trying to coordinate with Israel and the United States? What do we know about that?
Yeah, I would say the Turkish government of Erdogan wants Jolani to attack. Number one, their top priority is to attack the Kurds in the northeast of Syria. And this is why we see over the last 24 hours convoys of HTS and other Wahhabi death squads going towards the river of the Euphrates River and gathering around the dam on the Euphrates River around Raqqa, basically, to begin an attack on the Kurds. This is what the priority of Turkey is. Of course, the priority of Israel is that Syria acknowledges the existence of a Zionist colony and its occupation of Syria and give up on the Golan Heights. And we're already seeing the beginnings of that with the hints that Syria will accept the Abraham Accords. So there's these are two things that you see the priority of Turkey and Israel a little bit different. And Gulani is obliged, and he's doing whatever either of those two sides wants. And I think the bigger plan here is that Gulani will deliver on all the goals of the Turks, Israelis, and Americans in Syria, and that include this Abraham Accords or attacking the Kurdish militias. And in the end, he will be thrown into the garbage and replaced with somebody who will say, you know what, it's not my fault, Gulani did that. Okay, so this is ultimately the role that Gulani is doing. He's going to do everything that the Americans want and then exit the scene either through being killed by the Americans themselves and or disappeared and just doesn't, like bin Laden, we will all pretend that he got killed somehow.
When you talk about Israel and the United States in Syria, do you feel that they do want the same thing in Syria?
Yes, I think so, because now, you know, we have a Zionist empire. You know, some people may argue who rules, is it Tel Aviv or Washington, D.C. that rules this empire? I think it's irrelevant, this answer, because what's relevant is the actions on the ground. We can argue till we're blue in the face, but reality is both the aims of Washington and Tel Aviv are the same in Syria. And, you know, the main aim, as we see over the last 100 years of the Europeans in our region here, is to erase history that ruins the ability of the Europeans to claim to speak on behalf of Jews and Christians. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are our theological heritage. And the mere existence of Christian Arabs, of archaeological sites like the tomb of Apostle Simon Peter here in South Lebanon in Shema, are threats to this idea that Jesus is white and blue-eyed and blonde, okay? And or that these Ashkenazis from Europe are the real Semites, okay? And by the way, the tomb of Apostle Simon Peter was invaded by Zionists during the war here in Yemen and in Lebanon. And an archaeologist, quote-unquote archaeologist, Zionist archaeologist, went into the tomb. They desecrated it. They blew up the whole tomb. And nobody knows if they stole the remains of Apostle Simon Peter. And the significance about this, look, you know, maybe me and you are not, you know, religious or Armageddonist, but the significance of this is that according to the Christian theology, Apostle Simon Peter will come back with Jesus Christ to fight the Antichrist. And according to the Shia mythology, Apostle Simon Peter will also come back with the Mahdi. Okay, so the Zionists are desecrating the tomb of Apostle Simon Peter because they fear Armageddon. They want to, you see, our enemy believes these things even if we don't. Okay, and therefore, ultimately, to see how the Christians, including the Catholic Church, didn't say a word when the tomb of Apostle Simon Peter was destroyed and desecrated, just shows you how there's this fear in the Western capitals that claim, you know, that Arabs and the rest of the world will know that we are the real Jews, the real Christians, the real Muslims. And this will ruin one of the main propaganda points that the West has to control, which is claiming to speak on the behalf of Judeo-Christian, quote-unquote, civilization. I mean, they the true religion of Europeans is like, you know, the Viking Viking gods and or those leprechauns and fairies, you know. That's their real true civilization and religion. So I know I went a little bit on a rant here, but, you know, ultimately the goal of the West has always been to destroy the presence of Christianity and, you know, or destroy the historical record of our people here. And that's what they're doing.
Leith, when, with the situation in Lebanon and the way that Israel is attacking Lebanon, do you feel that the communication, the connection, the sort of talks between Hezbollah and the government in Lebanon is getting somewhere good or is worsening?
You know, I think it's not moving in any direction. Everybody is kind of playing these theatrics to avoid a confrontation. You know, the Zionists and the Americans want a confrontation between Hezbollah and the Lebanese government and the Lebanese military. And Hezbollah is avoiding it as much as they can. And the majority of the ministers are also avoiding it. Although we have the Minister of Foreign Affairs right now of Lebanon being part of the Kata'ib, the Christian supremacist party, who's making a lot of statements that are anti-resistance, but it's, you know, he doesn't have control of the finances or the military of the country, so it's insignificant, really, his statements, just statements. And, you know, when you understand that there's nothing that the Lebanese government really controls in Lebanon, not its finances, not its foreign affairs, not its military, and if you are in power in Hezbollah and understand that, then you understand that you really don't need to have a fight. You, the only fight that you have is with the United States, and it's direct fight, as we see. Israel is just part of the United States. So it's if Hezbollah falls into the trap of trying to fight over power in Lebanon, they will be distracted from the real enemy. And that's why they're not falling into this trap. How long can this game be played? I'm not sure. I look at the whole region at this moment as one battlefield. And whatever is happening in Yemen will affect what's happening in Lebanon and vice versa. And more than whatever is happening in the Lebanese government, you see? The future of Lebanon is more dependent on what's happening on the ground in Yemen than what is the actions of the Lebanese government.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point that you've made. Just to wrap up this session, Leith, with what has happened in Syria, do you think that the connection between Iran and Hezbollah has been weakened? Are they trying to do anything to improve that? How about that? What do we know about that?
Yeah, I think momentarily there was a huge loss with Syria falling to the HDS hands, specifically about the route of weapons deliveries to Lebanon, to Hezbollah. But that was momentary. And because the HTS government is so weak, really, it's the only power that it has is over unarmed civilians in Syria, minorities in remote villages that nobody can help. It can't fight Israel, it can't fight Turkey, they can't fight the Kurds, they can't do anything that America doesn't want. So it's a very limited power that HTS has. And this resulted in actually HTS trying to make deals with even Hezbollah and Iran. It may sound crazy to our listeners here, but they did. And one of those things is that Syria right now is dependent on smuggling of house gas, you know, propane for cooking, and diesel and gasoline for cars and trucks, on the smuggling coming from inside Lebanon. And those areas that the smuggling is happening for gas and gasoline are areas that are Shia on the border in the north or in the east. And therefore, HTS is begging Hezbollah to allow the continuation of the smuggling, because people will starve. There will be no machines that can move in Syria if this smuggling stops. In fact, I saw it with my own eyes. There's a pipeline coming into Lebanese territory, okay, that's dug and buried in the ground all the way to a Syrian village on the other side. And these diesel trucks coming and hooking up to this pipeline and pumping diesel to the other side, nonstop. Okay, so this means that HTS had to, for instance, in return for these services from Hezbollah, and behind them Iran, to allow some of the continuation of some of the weapons smuggling. Hezbollah had whole factories of weapons inside Syria. They allowed the dismantling of these weapons factories and the smuggling of these machineries into Lebanon. HTS allowed that. So this is how weak HTS is. And this also shows you how now, for sure, the supply route through Syria is active again. Maybe they're not delivering huge missiles that are going to be tracked by American or Israeli aircrafts that are flying, but everything below the tactical missiles is being still smuggled through Syria.
Thank you so much, Laith, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.